Hello and welcome to another exciting, no, riveting episode of Repro Radio. And today we are going to do something a little bit different in that we don't have an ECR guest for you, but we have two very well-renowned researchers in the heat stress physiology space, particularly as it pertains to animal reproduction. So we have Professor Pete Hansen from the University of Florida, who is one of the absolute gurus in heat stress reproduction research. And we also have Dr. Gordon Rafshorgi from New South Wales DPI, who, for any of our sheep producers listening in, he is a name that many of you will know from his work with small ruminants and lamb survival and various aspects of reproduction. So it's going to be an absolute cracker of an episode, and one which is really very relevant, not just to our academic community, but also to our farming community. If you are a sheep producer, also if you are a dairy producer too. So we're excited. You should be excited. Taylor, what are you excited about?
First of all, I can't believe you did not start this episode with some reference to it's getting hot in here.
Well, it is. What some of you won't realise is that we've pre-recorded all of these episodes in summer in Australia, and it is around about a million degrees in my office at the moment, and I'm unable to turn on the air conditioner because it's too loud for the recording. So I am sweltering and glad that we have moved to a audio-only podcast rather than the visual one. But no, it is getting hot in here, and it's getting hotter around the globe, as we all know and hear about frequently. And that's probably one of the big reasons why we have become so interested in the last couple of years in this heat stress issue in reproduction.
Yeah. For sure. Like, if you look at kind of the targeted funding calls at the moment, so many of them are around kind of climate change and heat stress. And there's so much work still to be done in the crossover between heat stress and reproduction. You know, there might be some people thinking out there, oh, we already know everything there is to know. There are a bunch of studies done, you know, kind of 20, 30 years ago looking at heat stress and reproduction. But I'm telling you, there's a lot still to be done. There's a lot of unanswered questions, and particularly the use of, you know, we come back to this every episode, but the use of these kind of more advanced assays, using those assays to kind of profile the changes that are occurring during heat stress. There's still a lot that we don't know, but what we do know is a bit scary.
True. I mean, if we could summarize the heat stress issue and what it does, I think that the general vibe is that it's bad. Heat stress is bad for reproduction. But what we'll learn a little bit more about today is exactly why it is bad and at what stages it is bad. You know, where is heat stress impacting reproduction? And then we'll also talk about some ways in which producers particularly might be able to ameliorate the effects of heat stress in dairy systems and also in sheep systems. So those are some great points to look out for.
Great. We'll jump into our first interview now. Don't forget to stick around for Repro News.
Today's episode is brought to you by Seaver Animal Health, the makers of Regulin. Regulin, more lambs when you want them. If you'd like more information about Regulin, then you can go to regulin.com.au.
Today, we have the great pleasure of being joined by Professor Pete Hansen from the University of Florida. Thanks so much for coming on to chat with us, Pete.
I feel very honored. This has been such a big hit, Reproduction Radio, so I am very thrilled to be here.
Oh, thank you. That's very kind. So tell us, let's start off a bit with your background. How did you find yourself working in repro?
So I guess, you know, I've always been interested in science since I was a kid, and I was from Chicago, a city boy, but my mother was from Ireland, the County Wexford. So we used to go over there and live on my cousin's farm. So he thought everything was work every day, but I thought it was like a great playground. And, you know, I was fascinated by reproduction even as a kid. When I went to the University of Illinois, I took Animal Science 101. And the very first section we had was on genetics. That was okay. Mm-hmm. And then the second one was on reproduction, and that was taught by Phil Schock, who was a very energetic, colorful lecturer, and that just got me right there.
It's crazy how common that story is, that people have this experience as an undergraduate, particularly with a lecturer that they just connect with. They see the kind of passion that they have for the discipline, and that's what starts it down this big long path that ends up being, you know, a decades long career in reproduction.
You know, reproduction for a lot of people is kind of an embarrassing topic, right?
And I don't get it.
And like our very first class, he said, okay, repeat after me, ovary, O-V-A-R-Y. And we all had to go, ovary, O-V-A-R-Y, penis, P-E-N-I-S. And we, what? Penis, P-E-N-I-S.
I love it. I think I might take that approach.
I also thought that was very clever.
Oh, that's great. And so then where did you go after your bachelor's?
So when I was at Illinois, I did research as an undergrad with a guy named Chuck Graves. And I did everything. Measured vaginal contractions in cows, tried to freeze mouse embryos. I could freeze them. They just wouldn't survive the process. And I studied puberty in rats. So I'm very grateful to him. He gave me the, you know, a lot of freedom and a lot of intellectual stimulation. So then I went to University of Wisconsin for my PhD and studied postpartum anestrus and puberty and beef cattle. And then I came to Florida in 83 as a postdoc with Fuller Baser and Mike Roberts. I always thought I'd go back to the Midwest, but I'm still in Florida, so.
So, Pete, you are very well known as one of the gurus of reproduction and heat stress, amongst other things. What first got you interested in this link between heat stress and fertility?
Well, a job.
It's always a good start.
Because I was hired as an environmental physiologist, not a reproductive biologist. So I thought, well, I'll study the effects of heat stress on reproduction because that's reproduction and environmental physiology. So I never really had much interest in heat stress before then because I kind of viewed it as a pathology. I'm not very interested in pathology. But, I think pretty much I've always thought, like, I love reproduction, but you could probably assign me to any field of science. Eventually, I'd find it the most fascinating thing there is.
So, that's a great trait to have.
I view heat stress as a very fascinating area.
And so on the topic of heat stress, can you tell us a little bit more? I mean, most people working in reproduction will probably have a pretty vague idea of kind of what the main effects of heat stress are on fertility. But can you walk us through some of what the major impacts actually are?
Yeah, you know, I guess it is. People could probably argue about this. We actually were discussing this at a students' committee meeting today. You know, the environment has a big impact on reproduction. But there are mechanisms that have evolved that allow environmental cues to shut reproduction down, like undernutrition. I mean, that's probably a physiological response to undernutrition that results in anestrus or prolonged postpartum anestrus periods. And of course, photoperiod regulates reproduction so that the young aren't born in times of year that are deleterious. But I don't. But heat stress, I think, is a pathology that mammals evolved to regulate their body temperature, not just at a constant level, but at a very high level. You know, pretty close to the temperature where proteins start to denature. So mammals spend a lot of time, a lot of energy regulating their body temperature at that constant high level. And when they can't do that anymore, things go wrong. And also, some of the things they do to preserve their body temperature have negative effects on reproduction, like they stop eating because feed intake causes the increase in heat production. And so, you know, I think, I mean, there's different ways of looking at heat stress. It has kind of large effects on oocyte development, large effects on early embryonic survival. And then the embryo is pretty resistant to heat stress, at least in terms of its survival. But still, once the placenta is formed, if a cow is heat stressed or probably any other female mammal, placental function can get compromised and fetal growth is altered. And of course, Jeff Dahl at University of Florida has really shown that that affects the fetus in a lot of ways, including its ability to produce milk if it's a cow when it becomes an adult. So yeah, it has a lot of effects.
And so are a lot of these issues happening when you get beyond, I guess, the thermoregulatory zone in mammals? So if we're just seeing behaviors that animals are using to kind of compensate increased heat, but they're actually still keeping their body level, their body temperature in an okay range, is that detrimental, or is it really when body temperature is not regulated anymore that you start seeing these impacts?
I think the latter. I mean,
yeah,
there is this thermoneutral zone where animals can regulate their body temperature without increasing their heat production. So below that point, you start shivering. And above that point, well, your body temperature is rising, and the very fact that it's rising causes your heat production to go up. So you're kind of in a vicious circle at that point. And, you know, I think it's at that point, when above the thermoneutral zone, when heat stress really starts to affect reproduction. And, you know, when is that point? So in a lactating dairy cow that's not really adapted to heat stress, it can be as low as 25 degrees centigrade.
Oh, wow.
So temperatures beings would think are, oh, that's very nice.
Yeah.
Cows are producing so much heat that they can't lose it all to the environment. Now in Florida, if you do those studies, that point is probably more like 29, 30 degrees centigrade. But the cows are probably physiologically adapted to heat stress. And then they're living in facilities where, even though the air temperature's high, the cows are being cooled. So it's probably more like 29, 30 degrees centigrade before hyperthermia occurs.
But humidity plays a role in that as well, right?
Yeah, humidity plays a big role. And solar radiation and wind speed. The combination of those things.
Yeah. So interesting. And, you know, you kind of touched on there the fact that, you know, there might be kind of negative effects if you go under that temperature as well and you start shivering, but it's more likely that the increased temperatures are really going to cause issues with reproduction. I imagine that in, you know, the last kind of 20 or 30 years, so much more interest has come into this area because of climate change.
Yeah, so I mean, from a dairy cow perspective, and admittedly that's not the only mammal around, when I was a grad student back in the 1970s, 1980s, heat stress was something people in Florida worried about, but in Arizona worried about, but most of the United States didn't worry about it. And of course, now you see depression in reproduction, depression in milk yield, just about the whole United States. And that's for two reasons, climate change for sure, but also cows are producing a lot more milk than they used to produce. So they're producing more heat than when I was a grad student. And so those two things together have made heat stress a much more widespread concern around the world.
Hey, can you tell us a little bit about your recent and current research focuses on this area with respect to heat stress and fertility? And maybe even chat through some of the biggest breakthroughs that you reckon you've made through the course of your career.
You're assuming there are big breakthroughs?
Oh, Pete, I know that there's tons. There's tons. Just lay it all out there for us. This is your moment.
You know, we've taken several approaches to try to reduce. We've mostly been interested in establishment of pregnancy, not effects of heat stress in gestation, but just getting animals pregnant after insemination. And initially, we spent a lot of effort trying to find ways to protect the embryo from elevated temperature, to artificially activate some of the cellular protective responses that all cells undergo. All cells except the very early embryo, because its genes are turned off. And that was pretty unsuccessful. And I always think I'm never going to do that again. And then I do it again. But we have not really found a way to nutritionally or pharmacologically protect the embryo. But, you know, in the course of that research, we became aware of the fact that the oocyte can be disrupted by elevated temperature really early in the process of oogenesis, you know, maybe 100 days before ovulation takes place. And then fertilization can be disrupted by heat stress, and the one cell embryo is very susceptible. But by the time the embryo gets to be a morula, like at day 5 of pregnancy, or a blastocyst at day 7 of pregnancy, it's pretty resistant to heat stress. Not completely, but pretty resistant. And so we started doing experiments, and the first ones were with Bill Thatcher and Martin Drost to see whether or not embryo transfer would reduce the effects of heat stress on pregnancy rates. And it does. I mean, it really does. Practically, most people who do embryo transfer are either superovulating heifers, which are less susceptible to heat stress because they're not lactating, or they're using frozen embryos produced in the cool time of year.
Yep.
Pietro Baroselli at University of Sao Paulo and other people in Brazil have followed up on those studies and done some really large scale experiments showing that embryo transfer, people will argue with me about this, it either completely eliminates seasonal variation in pregnancy rate, or greatly reduces it. Sometimes you can see a slight depression in some studies, a slight depression in pregnancy rate in embryo transfer recipients, but it's much less than for AI. The only problem is, and it's a real problem, you know, it's not really economically feasible unless the cost of the embryo is pretty low.
That's kind of the point that I was just about to bring up. You know, is this the way forward then? Is the idea to have everybody being, you know, undergoing an ET program, as you said, at a cool time of year and then transferring those embryos at a later date? But, you know, is that feasible given everything that's involved in embryo transfer?
Yeah, I'd say in the US it's not really feasible. You know, unless there's other value. So if you are a registered Holstein herd and you're trying to generate elite genetics, so you're getting a genetic boost by doing embryo transfer. But if you're a commercial producer, all you want to do is get a cow pregnant. You know, semen costs about $10, and embryo costs about, I don't know what, even $200. And you get higher pregnancy rate with the embryo, but unless the cost is really low, unfortunately, it's not really feasible.
Yeah, it's kind of, I guess it's kind of stuff that we often don't think about when we're in the nitty-gritty of the science is, you know, what does this look like for an end user? What does it look like for a producer if we're working in agriculture? And I mean, it's an important part of the picture, isn't it?
So now we're working on genetic solutions.
Right. Yeah. So tell us a bit about that. Yeah.
I used to think, well, that's never going to happen in the Holstein because the Holstein is such a superior animal to any kind of tropically adapted animal that crossbreeding will never work in the United States.
Yeah.
But now, of course, we're much more sophisticated about genetics. We can identify individual genes that affect phenotype and not transfer, you know, all the genes from a thermal tolerant breed, but just the ones that confer some thermal tolerance either by helping the cow regulate her body temperature or by protecting her cells from elevated temperature. Tim Olson at University of Florida discovered an allele in the prolactin receptor that causes real short hair. Cows look very slick.
this is a question I had for you, Pete. Yes. So I'm glad that you've touched on it. Please tell me what slick is because I see it on Twitter all the time.
Well, it's a great personal story, not for me, but for Tim. There was a dairy farmer around Tampa, Florida, and he bought some semen from his artificial insemination representative. And the guy gave him a cane of semen from the centipole breed, which was just being introduced in the United States in the 80s. And the centipole is from the island of St. Croix in the Caribbean. And they're pretty red cows. So the farmer was just curious. Perkle was his name. And he said, I wonder what the calves from these centipoles will look like. So he crossed some Holsteins with centipoles. And Tim Olson was down there and he looked at them. And he realized, hey, all these cows have very short hair. So Tim then went to St. Croix and he noticed all the centipoles have really short hair. And if they cross the centipoles with other breeds, the short hair is inherited as a dominant trait. So he bought all these crossbreds and then kept breeding them back to Holstein, 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 Holstein. So today at the University of Florida, we have the descendants of those cows. So they're essentially close to 100% Holstein, but we've always selected for this mutation. And after Tim did this, he was in Puerto Rico, and the producers down there said they had cows that they called pelonas, like baldies, and they had very short hair.
Yeah.
And it turns out that this gene, nobody knew this at the time, but people like Ted Sunstegard and Little John and Garrick in New Zealand have done a lot of the molecular genetics on this gene. There's at least six different mutations in the prolactin receptor that exist in South and Central America. They all cause short hair. And so there was probably a lot of selective advantage to inheriting this mutation. So the centipole likes probably 90% gene frequency for this mutation. So we've been studying those slick Holsteins, and yes, they regulate their body temperature better. They are less affected in terms of milk yield by heat stress. We don't have enough of them really to study fertility, but we will. And of course now there's people in New Zealand trying to market slick Holsteins, slick Jerseys, slick Holstein jerseys. There's several private producers in the United States who are marketing Slick Genetics and ST Genetics in the U.S. Slick Sires in the U.S. are selling semen from Slick Holsteins. I think everybody's still feeling out, you know, how big is the market, how important is this gene. But I'm confident, you know, eventually we'll get a lot of data so we can look at reproduction. And so now, you know, gene editing's been used. We're working with the Celligen in Minneapolis. So we have gene-edited jerseys and gene-edited Angus with the Slick allele. And they have real short hair. They're still calves.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think – so that's one gene.
Right.
And I'm sure there are others.
Yeah. It's nuts how much – I love seeing this expansion of a research program from one moment where somebody sees something, realizes something, and it just sparks this interesting trail of investigation.
We wrote a grant on 2001 on like a comprehensive approach to reduce the effects of heat stress on reproduction. And I put in, as one objective, we're going to study the Slick allele. And one of my colleagues said, "You just destroyed the grant. Nobody's going to fund that." That's ridiculous. And when the reviews came back, that's the part they liked the best.
Yeah.
We've spoken a fair bit about the science, but I have no doubt that you're also asked by industry with some frequency, you know, what advice do you have for our producers? You know, if it's we have in our audience, you know, dairy farmers and members of the dairy industry, if they're listening in today, you know, sort of what advice would you have for them? What can they do now to address some of these issues around heat stress or, you know, things that they should be working on or working towards in the future?
You know, I think on commercial dairies in the United States, the big focus is on housing and in barn design. So when people have the economic resources, people are developing or building new barns that do a better job cooling cows than the older barns. In terms of reproductive management, you know, the two big effects of heat stress, it reduces estrus behavior, reduces fertility. So you can bypass the effects of heat stress on estrus behavior with fixed-time artificial insemination programs. So it does not really improve fertility, though. Once you inseminate the cow, you're still going to have more or less the same fertility you would have had otherwise. And there's very limit. I don't know anything you can do right now to improve the likelihood of success after insemination. You know, embryo transfer will work. Mm. But it, like I say, in most cases, that's probably not practical. People have looked, you know, giving progesterone, giving GnRH, and there might be some small effects. Like we did a study giving human chorionic gonadotropin at day 5. I think we saw about a 4% increase in pregnancy rate. So there might be some slight benefits you can achieve with hormonal treatments, but nothing that, you know, I feel confident enough that I'd recommend somebody do right now.
There's quite a lot of advertising on the internet, and I have no doubt by some feed companies about various additives, feed additives that purportedly improve resilience to heat stress. I'm hesitant to ask you about this because you might not want to go on record and offend anybody, but can you just mention what those kinds of additives are supposed to be doing? What's the mechanism and perhaps your opinion on how effective they might be?
Or if there's any research to support the claims.
You know, there's some studies where either feeding yeast products or feeding seaweed can reduce body temperature in heat-stressed cows. You know, maybe there's some biologically active molecule in seaweed that sets the hypothalamus differently. But I haven't seen enough of that, like it were I would feel confident about it.
So there's none with your face on them yet.
No, that's right.
Melatonin is something which a lot of people are interested in Australia. Thoughts on that as a means to combating heat stress?
Yeah, so melatonin is obviously secreted by the pineal, involved in regulation of circadian rhythms and controlling or mediating responses of photoperiod. Also an antioxidant, and one of the effects of elevated temperature is increased metabolism, and one of the byproducts of increased metabolism is more free radicals. So we've spent a lot of time trying to reduce effects of heat stress in the lab or in the cow by giving different antioxidants. So melatonin is an antioxidant, and there's one paper from Lopez Gatias in like Barcelona or Northeast Spain that says using those implants that are designed for sheep that release melatonin improves conception rate in heat stress cows. So I can understand the biology of that as an antioxidant. The concentrations in the blood, though, are pretty low,
right,
for it to be an antioxidant. So maybe it's not real, or maybe there's other actions of melatonin. I mean, there are melatonin receptors on the ovary. And so, yeah, I've been very interested. I've never actually done an experiment with melatonin, but I've done it in vitro, but not in a cow. One problem with, I think, the way Lopez Gatias did his experiment, he gave the melatonin implants before calving. And I've been told, so I don't know that this is true, but I've been told that the fetuses have longer hair.
Really?
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So I'm not sure that's true, but it would be fascinating if it's true, saying melatonin crosses the placenta and
yeah,
makes the fetus think it's a short day, it should grow long hair. So it would be ill-equipped then as a newborn for the environment it's going to face.
Yeah, there's a lot of work going on in Australia at the moment in the sheep world around heat stress and the potential use of melatonin to combat some aspects of that. So be some papers coming out soon.
Yeah, there might be something to it.
I cannot believe up until this point that we haven't talked about sperm at all. And it's probably because it's not your forte, Pete. But tell us a little bit about heat stress and male fertility, because that's what I care about.
Yeah, you know, I think we're going to see a renaissance. I mean, we're already starting to see a renaissance in interest in the male for a lot of reasons. So there are well-known effects of elevated temperature on the male. I tried to write a review article about this, but I just keep putting it off. You know, I don't actually understand it because, you know, elevated temperature disrupts spermatogenesis, probably kills spermatogonia. And so after a male's exposed to heat stress, depending on how long the spermatogenic cycle is, the sperm that are produced are defective. And even after heat stress ends, there can be a period of time before those sperm clear the testis and spermatogenesis is restored to normal. But why does that happen? Because a turkey, a chicken, a emu, their body temperature is higher than mammals, and their testes are inside the body. So what's wrong with mammals? Why did we why are we so susceptible to temperatures that don't do anything to a bird? So people have evolutionary biologists have actually looked at that. So, you know, some mammals do have internal testes or have testes that can go in and out. And the best explanation I've heard is the advent of external testes is associated with the rise of body temperature in mammals as they got bigger and needed to run faster and have more muscle mass to compete on Earth, you know, as the ecosystems were changing back in the early days of mammalian evolution. So as mammals got bigger and had to run faster, having higher body temperatures were beneficial. But at that point, they had evolved testes that were functioning at 33, 34 C. So when their body temperatures went up, the testes had to go out. But there must be some genes that encode for proteins that are very thermolabile in the mammal, but are not thermolabile in birds. That's my theory.
I love that. You've just inspired me, Pete. Gonna have to write a grant about this now.
Yeah, there's a very good evolutionary biologist, I think, at University of Chicago, who's, I'll send you the paper if you remind me. He's looked at the evolution of body temperature in mammals and related that the location of the testis in the body. So this has been known for a long time. But what about the developmental programming?
Right.
Nobody's even looked at that. But now we know that insults to the male can affect his offspring.
Yeah.
So who knows about heat stress?
Yeah. And like something that's interesting to think about as well, that you kind of mentioned that when males or the testes undergo heat stress, that it kind of wipes out the germinal epithelium, but eventually, given enough time, it will reestablish. It's kind of an interesting question. Are the sperm that then develop, are they the same as prior to the heat stress, or are there kind of ongoing issues that are then being passed on to subsequent offspring?
Yeah, I think it's a really good question.
Thanks very much, Pete, for a really interesting interview with us. Thanks very much for coming on the show.
Well, I do want to say, I mean, being on Repro Radio is a thrill, and I love what you guys are doing. Everybody, believe it or not, everybody's talking about it. So it's really nice to be able to participate. So thank you.
No worries at all. Absolute pleasure.
We're back with Repro News. With spring Repro News, although it's not spring if you're in North America. I guess this is your fall Repro News. Sorry about that. But what do you have for us, Naomi?
For our fun fact for September, it's actually courtesy of Taylor, who found this in or linked it to me in the Bible that is Pathways to Pregnancy and Parturition by Sanger. Taylor, during e-stress, lions can mate more than 100 times, with mating occurring every 15 minutes.
Wowza.
Crazy. Now, look, lions are induced ovulators. It is estimated that lions can mate 3,000 times for every cub that survives to the yearling stage. So there was an instance where there was one male that mated 157 times in 55 hours with two different females. That's crazy.
And clearly did nothing else.
I mean, he's definitely better than the, what was the name of that Australian marsupial again that
The Antichinus.
Antichinus.
Yeah.
Definitely doing a hell of a lot better than that little fella. But that is a crazy number of times to mate in order to produce one little cub.
That is wild though, isn't it? It seems incredibly inefficient.
Yes.
To have to mate that many times to get a female pregnant.
Yeah, unbelievable. But yeah, really, yeah. The mate, like I said in the August episode or July episode, mating behavior in animals, just super, super interesting and diverse. Now let's go to our conferences that are upcoming. So we have the National Association of Animal Breeders, the 28th Technical Conference on Artificial Insemination and Reproduction. So this is actually being held this month on the 21st to the 23rd in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And then we also have the European Practitioner Symposium on Equine Reproduction. So this is in October on the 20th to the 21st. In Ghent, Belgium. And they also, this kind of links in with our training as well, that I noticed that they do have a couple of courses that they're offering. I think they might be on a waiting list now, but definitely sign up regardless. So they do have courses on embryo transfer and semen handling, which is very relevant to those in equine reproduction who are practitioners. In terms of other training, this is an organization that I worked with quite closely during my postdoc, Chagask in Ireland. I noticed that they have a number of, so they're an agriculture, should introduce them first. They're an agriculture and food development authority. It's a national body in Ireland. And I came across that they have quite a number of webinars on a range of livestock species and quite regularly, once a month, once every 2 weeks. And they cover a range of topics, including reproductive biology as well. So if you just need, you know, like I've got half an hour, just want to sit down and learn a little bit more, especially if you're in the industry, then they may be of use to you.
Also, if you just need a bit of a pick-me-up and want to listen to someone with a heavy Irish accent talk about reproduction, I don't know that there's anything better in the world, really.
I wasn't going to say it, but you basically took the thought out of my mind and just spoke it to the people. It's very true. For our awards or grants that are upcoming, I came across the Howard and Georgiana Jones Research Award in Reproductive Medicine. They don't have a date out yet. I believe this is a new award that they are offering. So it's an annual award that will be a total of $25,000 US. And this is for a one-year study period that will be awarded to two recipients. The purpose of the grant is to support innovative research projects that are dedicated to improving assisted reproductive technologies, or also related to in vitro fertilization. Now, finally, with our publication of the month, I came across this gem published in European Urology, The Genetic Architecture of Azoospermia, Time to Advance the Standard of Care. The essence of this paper was the researchers' search for a range of genetic variants looking at the single gene causes of azoospermia or cryptozoospermia in a large group of patients, and they found causal mutations for 1 in 12 men. And essentially the reason why, at least I found this research really interesting, is just further trying to develop diagnostic tools that they can use in clinics as a way to better guide patient treatment. And this research is really just one example of this. And also, you know, based on the results of this as well, indicating the success rate for testicular sperm extraction as well, because that's quite an intense procedure for someone to have to go through to then find out there's just nothing there.
Absolutely. I did not know this until I had to put a talk together a couple of weeks ago. I didn't realize how high the rate of failure was for testicular sperm retrieval. It's like 30-something percent. Like, that's pretty bad.
If someone could get tested genetically, or, you know, like in terms of, you know, using omics technologies to be like, maybe it's just not going to work for you, even if we go in through, you know, doing surgical sperm collections. I'm sure they would be both obviously devastated, but also I think quite pleased not to have to go through something that intense.
Yeah, absolutely. Because it always, the thing that I always come back to with these kind of human reproductive medicine procedures and these ones that are particularly invasive is, are we doing it for the right reasons? Is it a complete last-ditch effort? Is it fair to the patient to ask them to go through this or not? So I think anything that can help kind of answer some of those pretty gray area, muddy questions
100%, will, absolutely.
Yeah, will help to improve clinical practice for sure.
Yeah, so we definitely need a lot more research like this. Let's get our omics tools into clinics.
Let's do it, people. Do some work. Thanks, as always, Naomi, for a great repro news. We'll see you again soon.
See you in October, guys. Thanks for listening.
Okay, next up on Repro Radio, we have a real pleasure in being able to welcome a longtime friend and collaborator, Dr. Gordon Refshorgi from New South Wales DPI. Gordon, welcome to Repro Radio.
Thanks very much, Simon. It's a pleasure to be joining you.
Gordon, I thought we'd just kick things off with a little bit of an introduction to yourself. Anybody who is in the sheep industry will immediately know who you are because you are famous. But for those of you that may not know you quite so well, can you tell us a little bit about your research background and anything interesting that that you want to share? Would be wonderful. Also, a slightly dangerous question to ask you.
Look, I like the open questions. That's a good one to start with. So I'm a reproduction researcher with New South Wales DPI. Most of that work has been with sheep, and I've just started to get into some goat work as well, which is really great. The goat is a fantastic animal to work with, absolutely brilliant, hilarious, great character, very nimble, and has a lot of really important areas to research. But I've also been involved in meat science studies, a little bit of background in quantitative and molecular genetics in my early honours days, and working with in collaborative teams with the Sheep CRC's Information Nucleus Plot, for example. A dabbling in a bit of vaccine validation, a little bit of disease case studies, quite a lot of nutrition work in the last 5 years, and a strong interest in thermal impacts on livestock, particularly starting with cold stress and its effect on lamb survival. And I've done quite a lot of neonatal lamb autopsies, so I'm sort of known a little bit as the autopsy guy too.
Well, it's an excellent lead into really the topic of today's discussion, which is heat stress. I suppose a lot of if there's any producers that are listening, hopefully a lot of producers listening. Why is heat stress an issue for the Australian sheep industry? I mean, we've all worked on pretty hot days, but what kind of an impact, other than it's uncomfortable, what kind of impact is it potentially having on your sheep?
So firstly, yes, we're working in a very arid continent and country, and we've all been exposed to heat over time and in the past. So the first real concern is that the climate is changing, and it's changing quite rapidly. For example, Cowra's long-term average number of days in a year above 40 degrees was 0.4, so that's two events every 5 years above 40. And now we're averaging, in a 10-year average, 6. And that's like a hockey stick kind of graph, and that graph can be reproduced for lots of locations across New South Wales and into Queensland. So it's becoming hotter. So heat stress is important because it's becoming hotter, and we'll move to quite a hot place. And that's important because heat stress also affects the animal in a range of ways. It's not just effects on their welfare, but there's also production consequences. Heat-stressed animals will eat less, they'll seek more shade, they'll drink more water. In terms of reproduction, there's no phase of reproduction, no stage that is immune from heat stress. It will impair spermatogenesis in the rams. So an acutely heat-stressed ram will produce normal functioning sperm for the next 10 to 20 days. And after that time, we start to see an increase in abnormal sperm. We see reductions in sperm motility. So there's a lag effect that affects the ability of the rams to impregnate and conceive, like for the ewes to conceive with these rams that are heat stress. affected in the ewes, there will be effects on the embryo, on the ova, on the follicle. There's effects on the placenta as well. We can have effects on lactation and lamb survival. So all of the stages of the ewe's reproduction cycle, from behaviour, so expression of estrus, right through to lamb survival and lactation, can be impaired, and it depends on chronic and acute heat loads. So it's about timing. And, of course, also for the rams, their behaviour will be impaired. So there's effects on hormones, effects on feed intake, and they are the animals are prone at any stage of this reproduction cycle. So it's important biologically, and the consequences for Australian sheep producers can be economic, depending on the time of the year that they are mating and where they are.
Given it's a demonstrably important issue, presumably there's a bit of research going on in this area. What are you aware of that's currently being undertaken around Australia on heat stress in sheep?
I guess the answer, we can step back and look at what's happening in heat stress-based research, and there's been quite a lot of recent work in meat science-based work in sheep, particularly pigs, a lot of work in dairy and beef cattle. University of Melbourne has been leading a lot of that, and the University of Queensland. So those are the two major centres where most of our heat stress-related studies have been occurring. They've both got wonderful climate control facilities with scale. So they're great resources, and that's where most of the work's coming from. There hasn't been very much investment in reproduction research at all. We wrote a wonderful chapter in the Breeding Focus that was published last year, and in there we've got a table that defines or talks about all the Australian reproduction-related studies that have been reported and published, and the last of those is 1993.
Yeah.
So we've got a couple of decades under our belt, three nearly, with very little activity. There is some recent investment in this area. Our primary levy-funded organisations, Meat and Livestock Australia and Australian Wool Innovation, have recognised the importance of heat stress and its effect on reproduction and have included them into their strategic plans. And as a result, there have been a couple of projects, one of which has been able to estimate the impact of heat stress on sheep reproduction, which is between $97 and $168 million a year, and into the climate-affected future up to $260 million as an annual impost on the sheep industry. And there's some awesome, some recent behavioural work that's been led by UWA.
Yeah, there's some great reviews there, not just because they are written by us, as another great one from South Australia that Gordon's just mentioned. We can link to those on our website for anybody that is interested in checking out a little bit more detail on effects of heat stress on sheep. If we move to a conversation around the sort of work that needs to be done. I mean, it's a little bit of a loaded question given the fact that we've both been on the same grants that have been submitted a few times. But look, in your opinion, what is the work that really does need to be done?
There's a lot of low-hanging fruit, and there are a lot of research gaps in this area. If we want to, so it's the work by Peter Hansen, which is a publication going back to 2009, absolutely terrific piece of work, and it really talks about the modifications that are required to help our livestock production systems manage heat stress under the context of climate change. And they are modification of the nutritional environment, modification of the environment itself, and genetic modification. So if we just start with environmental modification, in a dairy context, we might be talking about misters and fans, and shaded artificial shade structures. In a beef or a sheep feedlot, that's possible as well. But in the farming system, it's paddock trees that will provide the shade. And, you know, look, Australia's, to be honest, Australia's got a track record of clearing our landscapes, and we have environmental laws that still actually allow for that. So what's missing in our landscape is connected shade structures, trees, essentially, particularly large mature trees. Now, I understand there are issues around those and depends on where you are too in the Australian landscape about how important trees are, whether they'll grow, and what it means for the rest of your farm system. But shade needs to be there. And we have some idea about how much shade is required, but there's no plan really around that. I don't think it's in the high on the agenda of planning in a farm level. Environmental, nutritional modification is really interesting. So that's where this work at UQ and UIM, University of Melbourne, is really insightful. There's quite a long list of feed additives that we can provide animals that will actually help them manage the consequences of heat stress, which aren't just elevated respiration rate and temperature. They're also reactive oxygen species, so antioxidants that will help mop up superoxide. Dismutase will work really well. It's got a couple of critical minerals that support that. We've got glutathione peroxidase, which relies on selenium and vitamin E. And so there's some nutritional supplements that we can provide these animals that will help mop up oxygen radicals, which will then help protect very sensitive cells like the reproduction cells, particularly around the follicle and ova and the early embryo. This is really critical. No work's been done on that. That's a big gap, and that's where we've been focusing. And that's we're really looking at just a couple of supplements, and there's actually quite a long list. So nutritional supplementation is important, but of course those levels at the moment when offered to livestock are very high in their concentrations of some of these antioxidants, and that can have a problem. And we haven't yet got the next step examined, which is how do you take climate controlled individually fed animal based diets out to the field where you have variable intake. So there's nutritional supplementation, environmental modification, and there's also genetics. Now, when we look at the literature, it points to species like beef cattle or dairy cattle that have very productive animals, and what's associated with that high level of production is a very large feed intake and greater metabolic activity, particularly around selection of muscling and fat and growth, particularly muscling and growth, and that raises set point temperature. Now, as the animal's set point temperature rises, the difference between the ambient temperature at, say, 37 or 40 degrees ambient temperature is smaller. So if the animal's already running hot, then its ability to manage heat stress is smaller and less and reduced. So much more productive animals are much more prone to heat stress. So in terms of genetics, what we really need to understand is what are the genetic relationships between selection for production traits and susceptibility to thermal impacts, such as heat stress and cold stress. That's a big gap. There's molecular-based work looking at heat shock proteins. They're absolutely fascinating, and there might be some favourable outcomes for other components of reproduction, such as lamb survival, for example, by focusing on that work. But it is all low-hanging fruit, all needs to be done. We're selecting our sheep to be highly productive, and we don't know what the consequences are for their susceptibility to heat stress, and I think that's a really big risk.
Look, absolutely. I think there's a ton of work to be done there, and look, I mean, fingers crossed we get some of this funded in the near future so we can get to the bottom of it and start making some genuine recommendations there across those three different areas. I suppose for producers now who say they're joining and they're facing a heat event, or they're thinking of trying to a certain extent future-proof themselves, at least for the next summer. This one's turned out to be not too hot. What would your advice be there? Perhaps we can just start with what's something that they can do now to try and future-proof their property or their joining period.
So if we think in the immediate term, standard take-home messages for sheep producers at the moment is really make sure the animals have shade during joining, make sure the rams have shade before joining, yeah, make sure water quality is really good, and don't move the animals in the middle of the day when it's a heat wave. That's critical. If you're looking at your animals and you're thinking about having to move them, or you have to move them for some reason, then look out for tongue out breathing, that's a good indicator that the animals are really not coping, and just allow them to go from shade tree to shade tree. You can count the respiration rate, so how many times the flank of the sheep will move per minute as an indicator of heat stress. And once they start to get above about 120 breaths per minute, which is 2 breaths a second, you've got heat load starting to accumulate in those animals. If you're thinking long-term, I would definitely be planting trees, absolutely definitely be planting trees that are suited to your environment that will cast shade in the future.
I think you're spot on there. One last question. We've both received some inquiries over Twitter about, you know, what to do if you've started joining. It's an incredibly hot week. Should producers be extending their joining period or just waiting for the best and seeing what happens at ultrasound? Any advice there for what people should do?
Look, there was one Twitter conversation. I think temperatures in West Australia were in the mid-40s.
Yeah.
And my advice to them was to keep the rams in because their sperm's going to be as good as it is going to be yeah. in the next 2 weeks, 2 to 3 weeks.
Yeah.
After that, you might start relying on a greater ram ratio and just hope that you've got tolerance inside your ram cohort and make sure that the sperm's still fine.
Fantastic. Well, Gordon, I think that's all we've got time for, but a huge thanks for giving us your time and your expertise today. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Simon.
Well, we promised a good episode and I believe we have delivered. Lots of information in there to digest on the effects of heat stress. As we mentioned at the start, bad. Heat stress is bad and it affects pretty much every aspect of reproduction. But a couple of key things that I would like to draw out there, one of them being that for dairy cattle and presumably other species as well, surprisingly significant effects of heat stress very early on in the development of an oocyte. So, you know, a couple of months prior to when it's ovulated.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, I always come back to the male side as well. Obviously, spermatogenesis takes time. And if you're having a heat insult way before you're joining or, you know, thinking about doing AIs, it might still be really relevant because of how long the system takes to first react to the insult, but then to get back up to normal function as well. So we're not talking about something that happens overnight. It may be, you know, 3 months after.
Absolutely. Another interesting point is that embryos, once they've sort of got through those first couple of divisions, they start to become a little bit more resilient to heat stress there. So that's probably not where you're seeing the main effects of heat stress. It's sort of before and to a certain extent, you know, after there are some impacts of heat stress on the placenta. As we say, the summary is it's a generally bad thing. So
it's not all doom and gloom, right? Like there's
it wasn't all
there's.
It wasn't all doom and gloom. And there were some nuggets of wisdom there from both of our guests about things that producers can think about doing now in order to ameliorate that heat stress. So things like housing being a very big one for sheep producers. You know, think about shade, access to water, not moving your animals around too much when it is hot. So lots of good stuff there and some of those things that Pete raised about genetic selection is really fascinating and good to learn a little bit more about the slick gene and these slick cows that we hear about so much online and increasingly in bull catalogs as well.
Absolutely. And, yeah, you know, that's obviously the longer-term strategy is kind of implementing some of this targeted selective breeding for, I guess, thermotolerance in general. But something people, I guess, could at least start considering working into their breeding programs.
Absolutely. And clearly more to learn there, particularly with sheep. You know, we don't have a good understanding of what happens when you do potentially select for some of these issues around thermotolerance and how that's going to impact subsequent production. So I would envisage some future research program calls around those topics in this space. So I think that's all we've got time for this week. Again, hope you enjoyed the episode. Our thanks to our two guests. Thanks as well to our sponsors. And, of course, as always, to Naomi for our Repro News. We look forward to joining you again next month.
Thanks for joining us. For more information about our guests today or Repro News, check out the show notes for this episode on our website. If you've got a question for our next guest, send us an email or find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Repro Radio is hosted and produced by me, Taylor Pinney, and executive produced by Simon DeGraff. Repro News by Naomi Bernicic, ACR Spotlight Reporting by Kelsey Poole, production assistance by Jess Rickard, Maddie Vanderhoek, and Sophie Waugh, and audio design by Dylan Gerrilly. No, Pete, what uni are you at?
University of Florida.
I'm sure all those American universities are the same, except maybe
then there's
Harvard,
like a thousand of them.
They're all somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. They're in some sort of state.
Doing something.
Okay, all right.